This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ranchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning, as always. And this is Father's Day weekend. Tomorrow is Father's Day. So, appropriately, we've decided to dedicate today's program to men's health. So, my guest today, and we're going to have two guests. First, we're going to be joined by Dr. Ted Iheanacho. Dr. Iheanacho is the chair of the Department of Behavioral Health at Trinity Health of New England. And we're going to be chatting about some of the mental health challenges facing men, especially as we get older and we start seeing suicide rates going up. So I really want to chat with him about that. In the second half of our program, we're going to be joined by Dr. Anthony Kim. Dr. Kim is a board certified urologist at St. Mary's Hospital, and he's also part of Trinity Health of New England. And I want to get some resolution, hopefully, to a very confusing topic, and that is prostate cancer. What is the appropriate screening? What is the appropriate treatment? We hear a lot about watchful waiting when people have prostate cancer. We hear about surgery, radiation, and also what should be done in the workup for prostate cancer. You know, everybody relies a lot on the PSA test. Previously, it was the digital examination. Which is best? Should both be done at your regular physical? We have a lot of questions for Dr. Kim, so it's going to be great to chat with him. As always, this day in medicine, June 17, 1867, was the first operation performed under antiseptic conditions by Dr. Joseph Lister. And what's interesting, he performed a mastectomy on his sister. That's back in 1867. So think back to that point. And remember, Dr. Lister really was the one who, he was a surgeon who explored how to do surgery with minimum infection, antiseptic conditions. It's probably the greatest product placement when you think about it. When somebody named a mouthwash Listerine, in the sense of taking the person who was responsible for antiseptic surgery and incorporating his name into a product that continues to be sold today. So, again, we remember Dr. Lister for his work in 1867. Reflecting upon a previous topic we talked about, if you'll remember, a few weeks ago we chatted with Dr. Lenore Williams. Dr. Williams was an obstetrician and gynecologist with the UConn Health Center. And we talked about maternal risk and maternal deaths during childbirth. And lo and behold, this week, Tori Bowie, who is a 32-year-old Olympic athlete, dies with an issue related to childbirth. It's believed, and it's not clear, she lived in Orlando, Florida, and it's believed that she had developed eclampsia. She was 8 months pregnant, and unfortunately her unborn child died as well. She may have had a seizure. But I think it highlights for us the risks involved with childbirth. Everybody takes it automatically, right? That, you know, you just push the baby out, okay? But that's not the case. And sadly, the United States continues to be one of the few countries. There are only 8 countries where the maternal death rate is increasing year to year. Right now, ours is 39 deaths per 100,000 live births. You might say, well, that's not that many. That's a lot. That's a lot of women dying in childbirth. And we try to look at it in a lot of different ways. For example, one factor, and it's not just one factor, okay? It's not one thing, okay? If I were to point to any single thing, it would have to be poor prenatal care. Because there are so few people going into obstetrics and gynecology, especially in states where they have highly restricted laws. Now, you might say it's all about abortion. I'll tell you what it's about. It's about being an obstetrician and doing what you think is best for a patient and then facing criminal charges. You don't want to go near, even if you don't do abortions, you do not want to be in one of those states because someone may question what you have done to protect the life of that woman. So this is a big issue. The other issues are prenatal care, as I mentioned, the health of a woman, and the fact that it's much higher in black women and other women of color and people who are poor. So as a country, it just distresses me to see our country compared to places like Haiti, okay, where we know there's just poor prenatal care in terms of women dying. And I hope maybe, sadly, maybe the death of Ms. Bowie will bring that to light a little bit more, especially in states where they threaten physicians with criminal prosecution. We're getting ready for fall, and this fall there will be new COVID shots. We've talked about this before, and it's coming to light, specifically the XBB 1.5 vaccination will be variant. It's a subvariant of COVID, and I think it's important for us to consider getting that booster along with the flu shot. And it's especially important in patients who are in high-risk groups. Sometimes it takes a doctor talking to you. I ask patients about their health and if they are not vaccinated, why? Because sometimes they have a health reason that they didn't get it. But, you know, I saw a gentleman this week, and I mean, he had a lot of risk factors. He was obese, diabetic. He had a heart attack and wasn't vaccinated. And I really wanted to point out to him that he's in that high-risk group. And I was very happy when he agreed to go across the street to get vaccinated over at the local CVS. So it's something to bear in mind, especially if you're in a high-risk group for complications from COVID. With that, we're going to take a short break. They're going to be back with my first guest, Dr. Ted Iannaccio, and we're going to talk about behavioral health in men as part of this Father's Day program. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be back with you. And with my first guest, Dr. Ted Iannaccio. Dr. Iannaccio is the chair of the Department of Behavioral Health at Trinity Health of New England. And he has been a previous guest on our program, and it's great to have him back. Ted, welcome back. Okay, Ted, are you there?
Okay.
All
yes,
right. Okay, we got you. Well, welcome back to the program. You know, today we're talking a lot about men's health, and I think it's something we don't pay enough attention to is mental health in men. Can you give us an idea, a scope of the problem and why we're facing a problem with this population?
Tony, thank you so much for having me today. This is a huge problem, particularly in the last couple of years with all the problems of COVID and family disruptions. Now more than ever, mental health for everyone, but particularly for men, is really important to talk about. We can give some numbers, but the reality is mental health from depression, anxiety, stress, post-traumatic stress disorder, panic attacks, all of these are common in men. They happen in men. The challenge is that they don't talk about it much, which is why we are trying to say it's very important to talk to someone about your emotional well-being. Start with a close person to you, and then seek help if you need it. That's really the message. But mental health issues are, you know, common in men as they are in other, in women and children and everyone. The only difference is men don't seek help much.
So I guess starting the conversation is always a hard thing. We're seeing more and more male athletes, Michael Phillips, other athletes, you know, come out about their own struggles with mental health. Has that helped the open the conversation from your standpoint?
It does help a lot when we have celebrities, athletes, actors come out and talk about their mental health. People feel more comfortable. People say, oh, if this person could be struggling with this, then it's okay for me to talk about it. I think that's a big element of improving the stigma around mental health when people who are well-known, either politicians, athletes, movie stars, celebrities of all types, talk about their mental health. It does help.
You know, there's always a fear that someone finding out about your mental health struggle is going to impact your ability to earn a living, especially among professionals. And I'm sure that was the case with athletes. And I think it's more with individual athletes who have some freedom to express themselves. How do people get around that fear? So you're a young or middle-aged professional man. You have a good job, but you're struggling, and that's when the struggles begin, I would think. You know, you have family issues, as you've mentioned. You have financial issues impacting. You have pressure at work. You know, how do you open that conversation and overcome that fear that they may lose their ability to earn a living?
Tony, that's a good point, and we can look at it from different ways. Number one, I just want to say clearly, the law protects, you know, employment and discrimination, you know, discrimination against you because of mental health disorder. So that is a known fact. But we know that, you know, some places stigma might still play a role. But I do want to say that the good news is that these days there's a lot more awareness among people of all kinds of life, employers, employees. People now are more aware of the impact of mental health, particularly in their own lives, family members, friends. So I think we are getting out of that old school thinking where, oh, if I know that this person has depression, I'm less likely to, you know, sort of want to hire them or something like that, or keep them on the job. I think that is a little bit getting a little better. I also want to say one quick thing is, if you don't seek help, for example, the chances are the mental health will get worse, and you may still end up losing that job because you're not going to show up. You start, you know, turning up late and start making mistakes and, you know, start reacting in things that you shouldn't react too much. And then you end up kind of losing the job anyway. So overall, given all of this together, it makes sense to really seek help. You don't have to tell everybody that you're struggling or what, but it's important to acknowledge it yourself, seek help, and get better.
So that's a great point, and I wanted to raise that as well. Now, when I was younger and in medical school, we were always taught about suicide and the highest rates being in older men over the age of 60. Typically, they were of Caucasian race. Is that still the case in men, or has that changed to some degree in terms of age, race, and socioeconomic level?
Tony, that's a good point. It hasn't changed much. I'll tell you some of the things that some of the nuances around it now. Still, at this point, that demographic, older white men are still more likely to die from self-inflicted gun death or completed suicide. So that is still a concern. I think one of the things that, and just to say, when men try to kill themselves, they are more likely to use deadly weapons like guns and knives and complete the process, whereas women are less likely to use more deadly processes. But one thing that has happened over the last couple of years is that suicide by overdose has increased among black people, particularly black men who use drugs. So that is something that has become more and more of a problem in the last couple of years, in addition to the known higher suicide rate among older white men, particularly who live in rural areas. So those are the trends at this point.
I could never figure that out, Ted, to be honest with you, because I'm thinking, all right, older white male. I mean, it's you know, you're getting towards the end of your career. You know, it's almost like the race has been run already, and I could never understand that. I mean, as to why someone at like that would be more prone. What are the common reasons someone commits suicide, an older man commits suicide?
So, Tony, that's a good point. I mean, not to go too psychologically deep for you here, but when you think about it, when you are younger, you have a reason to live, you've got a job, you need to, you know, find a mate, you need to build a career. As you get older, say, for example, you've done the race, like you said, and you've done a good career, and your kids have grown up and left, and some of your friends have died or moved towns. So then the question is, you know, what are you living for, right, in a certain sense? You need to, at that stage in life, you need to reinvent yourself almost. Like, what else is the purpose? What is driving you every day? So for a lot of people, that can be a challenge. Not everybody navigates that change much. But like I said, that's like a deep sort of psychological element to this. I do want to say that one thing to say right away is thinking of suicide is common. Even attempting suicide is common. The only difference is among that demographic, you're talking about older white men, access to guns is higher. So the chances of moving from thinking of suicide to trying to do something to oneself to actually doing it is higher because that weapon is there, the gun is there, right? So I think that's something to consider in this discussion as well.
I'm glad you brought that up because that is a big point. So families are getting together tomorrow for Father's Day. What should people be on the lookout for in their loved one, their father or other men in their families that would tip them off that they're having a mental health struggle and this may need to be dealt with? What should people who are listening today be on the lookout for?
First of all, Tony, I think the more important thing is to have fun, to show love to the man in your life or the men in your life. Actually say it, you know, we love you. We love having you in our lives. I mean, expressing that love and support and appreciation is very simple, but it goes a long way. And men don't always show their emotions, of course, not all the time, but I think it's something that deeply can help. To your point about what to look out for, I think the biggest telltale sign is usually when a change in behavior, someone who is the life of the party, somebody who is, vibrant, talking, and is withdrawn, doesn't want to get together, doesn't want to socialize, that's almost always a telltale sign that something is off, and that's a good time to say, are you okay? Is everything going all right? Just checking with them when you see that change in behavior. I also think something just because we're talking about the holidays and men being Father's Day on Sunday, it's good to think about substance use. I think that is something we always should wonder about and hope we don't overdo it or see if things are getting out of hand and encourage people to seek help.
Ted, thank you. Thank you for everything you do, but more importantly, for making people aware of the risks and the signs of a mental health struggle in men. Thank you, Ted. Appreciate it, as always.
Thank you so much. And I just want to say, just because we talked about suicide, I think it's important for people to know that if you're having thoughts of suicide, there is a national helpline that's called 988 that you can call and talk to someone and get help.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Great job, Ted. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. And as Ted said, if you have a loved one or if you are contemplating suicide, we do have that 3-digit number of 988 now. I think it's important to be aware of the mental health of everybody around us and not be fearful of confronting. It may be the greatest act of love to confront somebody and offer to help them and show them some love. With that, we're going to take a short break. Now we're going to be back with my next guest, Dr. Anthony Kim, who is a urologist. And we're going to try and resolve some of the confusion around prostate cancer. We're going to talk about testicular cancer. Today we are talking about men's health here on Healthy Rounds. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And in this second half of our program, we want to continue our discussion on men's health, and we brought in Dr. Anthony Kim. Dr. Kim is a board-certified urologist at St. Mary's Hospital and part of Trinity Health of New England. And we want to get down to some of the not so much controversies, but issues that are somewhat vague regarding men's health, especially with regard to prostate cancer. Tony, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tony. How are you? Thanks for having me.
All right. Pretty good. Hey, can you tell our listeners a little bit about your background and what goes into being a urologist?
Sure. So my name is Dr. Anthony Kim. I went to medical school at Boston University. I did my five-year urology residency, which included 2 years of general surgery at Yale School of Medicine. I've been in private practice in Middlebury, Connecticut for the past 20 years. Most recently signed on as a urologist for Trinity Health of New England. I'm currently in a practice with two other urologists and several APRNs.
So what kind of the scope of things you see in your average day in urology?
So, you know, urology just in general is a field which deals with disorders of the urinary tract as well as sexual dysfunction. It's true, most of our patients are male, but about 25 to a third of our patients include women as well with any number of urologic abnormalities. In men, commonly we see patients who have issues related to an enlarged prostate or an elevated PSA with concerns of prostate cancer. But the other types of things that we take care of are kidney stones, any sort of urinary tract infections, problems with control of urination, erectile dysfunction, infertility, those types of things as well.
We hear the concept all the time of men's health centers. What mm-hmm. makes up a men's health center?
Well, you know, I think what most doctors are beginning to realize is that urologic issues tend to affect patients sort of globally. And there's so many interactions with other medical issues in which a urologist is almost like an adjunct for the primary care doctor, but specifically for urologic issues. As far as any number of, as one gets older, the prevalence of any type of urology issue is so common that to have a focused area which will deal with men's health, I think allows a patient to have almost an ease of access to taking care of some of their problems.
So let's get right to it. So in prostate cancer.
Yeah.
Screening for prostate cancer. Everybody
sure.
gets a PSA now. We used to get a digital exam and have that mm-hmm. as part of our primary care evaluation.
Sure.
Is that the best screening to be done, is the PSA with the digital exam, or as some physicians say, the digital exam has become somewhat obsolete in mm-hmm. view of the PSA?
Well, you know, I think the digital exam gives up. So just as far as prostate cancer screening goes, within the urology community, most primary care docs understand that prostate screening should involve both a PSA and a prostate exam, a digital rectal exam, in all men over the age of 50. 50 years old. So usually the PSA, and remember, PSA and a prostate exam, they're not diagnostic sort of tests. I think some of that is what leads to some of the confusion regarding screening. It's just meant to stratify what one's risk of prostate cancer is. Prostate cancer is the most common type of cancer that affects men over the age of 50. I think it's like second most common other than like non-melanomatous skin cancer. And so, you know, I think statistically there's like 300,000 men in the U.S. that get diagnosed every year and accounts for 30,000 deaths per year. It's not an insignificant type of thing. My practice is that both should be done, both a PSA and a rectal exam. And all the studies have shown that your sensitivity for screening is best when you do both of those.
Well, let's move on. So you have some suspicion. And now, what's the next thing in terms of working somebody up for suspected prostate cancer?
Sure. So, you know, it really depends on the individual and what your suspicion is. And, you know, PSA, there are other things that can cause a rise in PSA. And I tell patients this all the time. So typically in patients between the age of 50 and 70, we use a PSA level of 4. As sort of the demarcation point between high risk and low risk of having prostate cancer, or elevated risk, I should say elevated risk and low risk of having prostate cancer. What I typically do when patients get referred to me for an elevated PSA or an abnormal prostate exam is that I'll recheck the PSA. The PSA is not a static number, and it can go up and down for a variety of reasons. An elevated PSA doesn't always necessarily mean prostate cancer. I mean, it can be related to a significant benign growth of the prostate. It could be related to an infection of the prostate. So, you know, that's where our clinical exam, our DRE is kind of helpful. It will sort of allow the doctor to truly assess what one's risk of prostate cancer is. And let's suppose the PSA is elevated, we recheck it, PSA is elevated again. The prostate exam may or may not show an abnormality. Now, remember, a prostate exam is kind of limited as well because you can't examine the entire prostate. There is a part of the prostate that is inaccessible on a prostate exam. So if the risk is there, then what we would do is we would talk to the patient about what our concerns are, what are the possibilities of an elevated PSA, talk about what the procedure to diagnose the prostate, to diagnose prostate cancer would be, and sort of go together with what we call like joint decision making. That being said, there have been newer technologies that have been available to us over the last year or two that have helped us stratify the risk of prostate cancer even further beyond the PSA and prostate exam. There have been new types of MRIs that have been very sensitive at examining the prostate and indicating what one's risk of prostate cancer may be. There have been newer types of blood and urine tests looking at what we call genomic or DNA markers within cells that also can allow us to stratify what one's risk of prostate cancer would be. But ultimately, if there's a concern for the risk of prostate cancer, the only way to really know is to do a prostate biopsy.
Okay. Let's take that a little bit further. So you make a diagnosis of prostate cancer. And say it's an older man in their 50s or 60s. What next? Because, you know, the latest article in the New England Journal from April of this year looked at that large series. I'm sure you're familiar with it, the 15-year outcomes after monitoring, you know, and they looked at watchful waiting, prostatectomy, and then radiotherapy. What do you do?
Well, yeah, see, that's the thing in which it really, there's so many factors of it. I mean, one is the and that that's sort of an issue with that New England Journal article, is that it sort of looked at prostate cancer globally and didn't really dissect maybe the different types or stages of prostate cancer.
Sure.
There's no question that prostate cancer is a slow-growing cancer in general. You know, when they looked at, there was a trial, I think through the National Cancer Institute, called the Prostate Cancer Prevention Trial, and you know, they had 2,000 men that they biopsied everyone, and even patients under with PSA less than 4, there was like a 15% risk of prostate cancer. But the type of prostate cancer that was clinically significant was only 0.3%, meaning that there are types of prostate cancer in which you don't need to necessarily treat. And those are patients in which we do what's called active surveillance. Now, it's not burying our head in the sand and pretending like the prostate cancer is not there. I mean, there is some follow-up involved with repeat PSA sometimes, or a repeat biopsy in the future. But it's important to understand, I tell all patients this, that a diagnosis of prostate cancer doesn't necessarily automatically mean that one has to proceed with treatment. And when they looked at that New England Journal article, the one thing that kind of struck me too is that in patients who have, granted, the mortality rates were similar, meaning that the number of people that died from prostate cancer in active surveillance, surgery, and radiation were the same. There didn't appear to be a significant difference. But the number of men that progressed to metastatic disease was definitely higher in the active surveillance group. And that's something that needs to be teased out a little further. So going back to this sort of clinical scenario, somebody does have an elevated PSA, we end up doing a prostate biopsy, we get the results and it's prostate cancer. The things that I look at would be, what's the grade of the prostate cancer, how young, what the age is of the patient, what their general health status is. Sometimes the way that you treat a 50-year-old with prostate cancer may be different than the way it would be different than the way you would treat a 75-year-old with prostate cancer. And I would talk to them about those types of options, whether it be active surveillance, robotic prostatectomy, or radiation therapy, and also the risks and benefits of both. When you look globally at the statistics, granted, in someone with clinically localized prostate cancer, 10-year survival rate is like 97%. But if you look at patients with metastatic prostate cancer, 5-year survival rates are like 30%. So what that says is that if you have localized prostate cancer and stay localized, you're going to do fine. The one thing you don't want to do is progress to metastatic disease.
You know, and when I read the article, that's just a hard thing to swallow, the idea of not doing anything. And,
yes.
And I agree with you. It didn't take into consideration that living with metastatic prostate cancer, especially when we know it goes to bone and spine quickly, is not a pleasant outcome by any means. So, I felt that it was misleading, to say the least, to say that it was, that active observation was just as good as surgery or radiotherapy.
I think that the takeaway that I get from it, too, is that it really, you know, nowadays when we talk to patients and we counsel patients, it has to be a joint effort or joint decision, you know, and I think what it does tell me in certain types of patients, yes, active surveillance is the way to go. And I think, you know, most overwhelming number of urologists believe that now, is that if you have low grade, low volume prostate cancer, chances are statistically that that's not going to cause much of an issue. But there are patients who are younger, who have more aggressive types of prostate cancer, and you're not going to really be able to tell the difference between somebody who has low grade, low volume prostate cancer, or more aggressive, higher grade types of prostate cancer, unless you do a biopsy. And so those patients with higher, and that's the next step, is to stratify those patients into the, what their pathology grade category is, and see if there's a difference, you know, between the three types of modalities. And I think you pick up on a really interesting point too, is that I think there's too much stress on survival, because, you know, I think what we all understand is prostate cancer is such a slow growing type of thing. Mortality rates, we have effective ways to improve one's mortality with prostate cancer at all different sort of stages. But it's the morbidity of metastatic disease that I think is the thing to really look at. It affects patients. I mean, I see it time and time again. You know, this, it causes pain. It decreases one's ability to function independently. It requires heavy duty drugs at times that have a whole number of other side effects as well. That in some ways sometimes can be much worse than primary treatment. So, you know, I think there's a lot of nuance to the way that you treat prostate cancer. And I don't think you can generalize it just by saying it's better to do nothing.
Ted, I'm going to shift gears here. We only have a few minutes left, and I really want to talk about benign prostatic hypertrophy, since we're on the prostate.
That's this is a something very that affects, common thing.
Yeah. Now, this affects a lot more of your patients.
Absolutely.
Can you tell folks what this is and the treatment? Because I think even this is somewhat controversial.
Yes. I mean, so just to give folks a general understanding of the anatomy of the prostate. So the prostate is a gland that sits underneath the bladder, and the urethra, which is the tube that drains urine from the bladder, goes right through the prostate. And as one gets older in the prostate, in all men, the prostate grows to some degree. It can create a resistance for urination and make it difficult to pee. Common symptoms would be waking up frequently at night, difficulty emptying out the bladder. Sometimes it could be so severe in which a patient is unable to urinate altogether and they have to go to the emergency room or have a catheter placed to help them drain the bladder. Just like with any other or most urologic issues that we deal with, there are certain types of grades or levels of severity of benign prostate hyperplasia. So, you know, initially, if a patient comes in and they're having more frequent urination, difficulty urinating, what we'll do is we'll see them in the office. We'll rule out some of the other types of things that can cause symptoms like that, like an infection. We'll check a urine. We'll do what's called a bladder scan, which will help us determine how well a patient is emptying out their bladder, because if a prostate's really causing some issues, we may find on this bladder scan that the bladder is not emptying out appropriately. Now, in early types of BPH symptoms, if a patient is having, you know, moderate symptoms, although they're emptying out the bladder, and it's not really bothering them so much, I may just watch it. I may not offer any type of treatment. If patients start to have symptoms in which it's really worsening their quality of life, although they're still able to empty out their bladder somewhat well, I may try to I may try some medications to open up the prostate and allow them to pee a little bit more freely. The typical type of medication we'll use is what's called an alpha blocker, which is a type of prostate medication that will relax the tension that the prostate puts on the urethra. It'll help open up the urethra, and it's very effective, and patients do great with it. They notice a stronger stream, less waking up at night, and they do very well. But as time goes on, as the prostate continues to grow, patients may develop further symptoms despite being on these medications. And that's kind of the next step as to what we would counsel patients as to how far to go after that. Now, if a patient is healthy, they run into an issue in which they can't pee altogether, they have a catheter placed, medications haven't been strong enough to allow one to remove the catheter safely, then sometimes we're talking about like a procedure or surgical intervention to open up the prostate and allow patients to void more naturally.
Do you do that with the laser? Because it was interesting. I spent time in Haiti, and we had a group come over from the Mayo Clinic. They brought their laser and did the laser prostatectomies. And I'll never forget the sight of all these men lined up. And in Haiti, the treatment for prostatic hypertrophy was putting a catheter in, a suprapubic catheter, and they'd be holding their bag, and there'd be this long line of men waiting to get terped with their with the laser. Do you find that to be effective? Do you use that?
I do use a laser. So, you know, the gold standard is what's called the TURP, or transurethral resection of the prostate. And a very simple way of describing that, it's like scraping out the prostate, hollowing out the inside of the prostate, removing that obstruction to the bladder, allowing one to pee. Now, the TURP procedure, where we use essentially like an electrical rake to scrape out these the tissue, very effective at allowing patients to pee, but had some side effects as well. Patients that have a significant amount of bleeding, sometimes the electrical current could affect the sphincter muscle or some of the nerves that feed into the penis that will allow one to have an erection. There would be issues with incontinence, ED, with after a TURP. So then newer technology developed, and I personally use what's called the green light laser, where it effectively opens up the prostate similarly to a TURP, but it uses a laser to vaporize the tissue. So the benefit of it is that there's very little to no bleeding. Patients don't have to be admitted to the hospital afterwards. They can go home the same day. Because the laser only affects tissue that it's in contact with, there's no propagation of energy. So I find the risk of like incontinence or any sort of sexual dysfunction to be much less with the laser, and still able to achieve that opening in the prostate that will allow patients to pee much more freely.
Ted, I had a quick question come in by email. Just wanted to bounce it off you, and that is prostate cancer. Does it run in families?
It does. There are subsets of men who have a familial association with prostate cancer. So anyone who's got a first degree relative with prostate cancer, typically the screening protocol would start at age 50, but anyone with a first degree relative with prostate cancer usually will start screening at 40 or 45 years old.
Ted, thank you. Thank you for your time today. Thank you for everything you do. I have to get you back on. This is great information on men's health. No. Thank you again.
Well, Tony, thank you for having me.
All right. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Korza has been on the board. Thanks to our guests, Dr. Ted Iannaccio and Dr. Anthony Kim. If you want to reach Dr. Kim, his phone number is 203-709-8326. If you're interested about a prostate issue or any other urologic issue, whether you be a man or a woman, you could reach Dr. Kim. And next week, we're going to be talking a little bit about the workforce issues affecting all of medicine. With that, next up on WTIC is Law Talk with John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Everyone have a great Father's Day, and please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.